Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now is Christian Amanpour, CNN's chief international correspondent and host of her show on CNN and PBS. If you haven't heard the news yet, her PBS show is being made permanent after these months of temporary scheduling where the Charlie Rose show used to be. We'll talk to Christian now about the media and the world. Thanks for coming on again, Christian. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, it's a great pleasure, and I think I've sort of become part of your public broadcasting family.
Welcome. You should have been here a long time ago. Can you tell us what the new show will be?
Well, look, it's going to be for PBS called Amanpour & Company, which means I will continue to do these meaty interviews that I've been doing as an interim basis since early December. And then it will incorporate four, at the moment, highly regarded, highly experienced contributors who definitely are well-known to the PBS and public broadcasting audience, to radio, etc. For instance, Michelle Martin and Walter Isaacson, Harry Srinivasan, and Alicia Menendez. And I think it's a really good group of diverse views and cultural references and the kind of context that they can add to what I've been doing over the last many months.
That's the same Michelle Martin, who's our own Weekend All Things Considered host?
I believe it
absolutely
is.
Absolutely is. And will CNN and PBS be airing the same show?
Yes, they will. That is the objective at the moment. And currently, they do air the same show.
Yes.
It's CNN International, so my show, which is on CNN International called Amanpour, is broadcast around the world and on CNN Go, wherever you are, and obviously online, etc. But with the new move to an hour, that also is being previewed to air on CNN International as well as on PBS.
It's really interesting, actually. PBS is a public network whose audience is in the U.S. CNN International, as you were just saying, is a commercial network whose audience is almost everywhere but the U.S. Programmers would traditionally put different content on for those audiences. How will you serve both at once?
Well, look, you know, it may be right what you're saying about different, you know, niche targeting, etc. But I am sort of in the CNN DNA. I've been at CNN since, you know, 1983. My career on air started before there even was a CNN International. You know, I was on CNN, period.
Mm-hmm.
And I still am in various guises, just not the actual show. And so I have always sort of treated both my American audience and global audience the same, frankly, as people who are interested in stories about what happens not just in their own backyards but around the world. And a story is a story is a story, and news is news is news. And I do think people all over the world, in the United States and around the world, do, you know, react and respond to that well. I don't think you have to be too niche for it, but I think that the international audience will certainly benefit from this new group of contributors, certainly when I say new, for an international audience.
Right.
And I think it'll give them an even deeper glimpse inside the United States at this particular time.
Yeah, I think it's really groundbreaking because Americans are often allergic to international news more than most
mm-hmm.
other people.
Yeah, well, you know, Brian, that's a real problem. And I have to say, I'm pretty proud of my record in trying to buck that trend. And I've never tried to dumb it down, and I've never tried to shy away from being an international correspondent. You know, it was Ted Turner, our founder and boss, the great visionary who changed the entire landscape of, you know, how you get your news back in 1980 when he created the first 24/7, which was us at CNN. You know, he banned us from using the word foreign. So we're not foreign correspondents, we're international correspondents. And that's not just a weird fetish. It's about understanding where we are as people and as a shared humanity. And so I've taken that mandate incredibly seriously. And even though I'm not American, I broadcast to an American audience and I broadcast to a global audience. And I think what people get from me after all these years is a level of understanding where I come from, in that, you know, my professional credentials, the trust, the brand, the, you know, the facts, the experience, the being in the field. And that's what it's all about. And so I think at this particular time, when there's so much misunderstood, willfully misconstrued conversation about the other, you know, the foreigner, the immigrant, the big boogie guys, you know, men, women, and children being demonized just because of where they come from. I think it's even more important now to cross this great ocean that can be an ocean of distrust and try to build bridges across it. And that is what my career has always been all about. And I hope this new expanded 1 hour on both CNN and on PBS will contribute to that dialogue.
I saw you asking tough questions to both Israeli and Palestinian leaders about the awful events in Gaza this week. How do you approach reporting or interviewing on something like that when the points of view are so emotionally polarized?
Well, it's not just emotionally polarized, and this is where we get into a lot of problems and disconnect with accurate reporting. It's politically polarized as well. As you know, it is incredibly difficult to report from Israel, sometimes also from the Palestinian territories, without being accused of taking a point of view, pro or con. And so it's very difficult to thread that needle. I do it because I think people know that I'm objective, that I've been on the ground, certainly in Israel, in the Palestinian territory since the early 90s, and I've spoken to the leadership and to the people there over the last three decades at least. And I've been through the various peace processes from the first one, the Madrid conference called by President George H.W. Bush in 1991, which began the era of a possible peace between Israel and the Palestinians. And so I do try to hold both sides to account. I am horrified as a human being and as a reporter by the disproportionate use of force by the massively, you know, superior Israeli offensive forces. This was really, you know, unbelievable to see that amount of death, that amount of live fire. And I took the Palestinian leaders to task for, you know, the some of the protesters who weren't peaceful. But I think that I've never known a U.S. administration not to to urge restraint on all sides, and they haven't urged restraint at the moment. And I think it's a real problem. I think that when we start getting out of balance, we can't find the truth. And we have to be able to find the truth, especially of this story.
I'm curious to get your take on the U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. The other participants are trying to stay in the deal, and that is much of the rest of the sort of high-power world, England, France, the EU, Russia, and China all staying in. If only the U.S. reimposes sanctions on Iran, Christian, can the other parties provide enough sanctions relief still that Iran would stay in the deal on its nuclear program commitments?
Not at all clear, and that's what's so depressing about this. Look, all your listeners, all your, you know, your people who listen to this program and to the news in general know the administration's point of view, the Israeli government's point of view, and that is not the consensus in Israel, but the government's point of view, the Saudi and the Emirati point of view, is that let us squeeze Iran to the maximum so that it essentially capitulates and surrenders. That is what they believe that they can do, which was the policy before the nuclear deal. The problem is it probably won't work. And so what's happened is that the baby has been thrown out with the bathwater, a deal that is not perfect on all issues but does constrain the nuclear dimension has been tossed out in favor of a fantasy deal that the U.S., the Trump administration thinks that they can achieve. So the Europeans don't believe that, the Russians don't believe it, the Chinese don't believe it, the rest of the world doesn't believe it. So they are trying to save this deal, which keeps America safer, Israel safer, the whole world safer, because it prevents Iran from getting a nuclear weapon in the foreseeable future, actually forever. To be frank, the deal prevents Iran forever from going for a nuclear weapon. So now the Europeans just right now are talking to the Iranian foreign minister in Europe, in Brussels, trying to figure out, can they save it? But the question you raise is the important one. Will Europe be able to stand up to any threat by the United States to sanction their companies and their businesses if they also do business with Iran? And if that's the case, if Europe can't get a carve out, so to speak, and can't stave off secondary sanctions, then this deal is probably going to collapse. And then we're back to square one. And I would say, honestly, that let's say the fantasy is that the regime collapses, Mm-hmm. Well, okay, it collapses, but you've seen the problems with collapsing regimes all over the Middle East over the last few years. But let's say the reality, the more likely reality is that this moment in time begins Iran going back to an untrammeled nuclear enrichment and maybe even deciding that it's in their interest to go for a weapon, or you see this leading to a different kind of attempt at regime change by the United States, Israel, and maybe others, which is a military intervention. You'll be able to trace that to Donald Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the deal.
Could you just clarify what you said about the Iran nuclear deal stopping Iran from developing a nuclear weapon ever? Because what we always hear is that one of the shortcomings of the deal is they've only agreed until 2025.
Yeah, well, there is this sunset clause, but that is agreement on levels of uranium enrichment that the Iranians have always said are for their, you know, energy and medical and other reasons. In the preamble to this JCPOA, the deal that was signed and enshrined, by the way, in the United Nations, it is a UN deal. It, in the preamble, has Iran pledging never, in perpetuity, never to pursue nuclear weapons. So that's what I mean by that. I mean, look, you know, you never know, but that's what the deal enshrines under the United Nations.
Before you go, Christiane, I saw you were on CNN's Sunday media show, Reliable Sources, talking about Trump's new threat to take away press credentials if he doesn't like how a reporter or news organization is covering him. What did he say exactly?
Didn't he say something like fake news is negative, or we're going to talk about pulling credentials?
Yes. I've got the tweet here. Should I read the tweet? He says,
if you like, because I don't memorize his tweets. Right?
that's a good practice. Why do we work so hard in working with the media when it's corrupt? Take away credentials, he wrote as a question mark.
Well, look, the big issue there is the word corrupt. I would strongly push back against that. I would be incredibly angry to let that word corrupt stand. And then I'd say, welcome to my world, when I go to countries all over the world which are non-democratic, which, you know, tend to, or do, as a matter of policy, slap down the free press and put them in jail and silence them, essentially, not to mention killing them. You know, this is ridiculous. This is the United States of America, which is the only country with a constitutionally protected mandate for free speech, free expression, etc. It's called the First Amendment, and we all look up to you, and we work bound by that constitutional right. And we have our responsibility to be honest, truthful, objective, and not, you know, take political positions and report without fear nor favor. The president himself, in another tweet, which I haven't memorized except for this bit, talks about fake and then in brackets negative, which we've always thought. You know, when he says fake, it clearly means that bit of the news that he doesn't like, that stuff that's said about him that he doesn't like. That's not fake. That's just stuff that he doesn't like. So, look, our job is to hold power accountable, to stand up and shine a light in all those corners, whether it be in the United States or in, you know, wherever it might be, Russia, Afghanistan, Iran, wherever it might be. And that's very important that we continue to do so, and that the entire media community in the United States, we're all bound by the same constitutional protections, stands up for each other and does not allow one or another to get, you know, beaten around and beaten up without a group and a community resistance to that. And may I just come back to the first question? Just as we were talking, a news story has flashed, whereas the Israeli army spokesperson admits that Israel failed to minimize Gaza casualties and that Hamas won the PR war by a knockout. Mm. I think that's a really important mention, given that that's how we started the conversation.
And yes, here's that that other tweet you mentioned from Trump. The language is 91% of the network news about me is negative, parentheses, fake. So I don't think I've ever seen an equation by a president of the United States between negative stories about him and the idea that a negative story is fake. It's an assault on truth.
Right. I think we should be very careful about that, because what you've just said, we are seeing an unprecedented assault on truth from the very highest levels of elected power in our democratic world, in the most powerful country in the world. And it has led to copycat attacks on truth and those who seek and report the truth all over the world. And it existed, but now they're getting more enabled by the President of the United States. And the worst thing is, they're not just using it as a convenient weapon to bludgeon us with. In various countries, they actually believe that if an American says that the journalists are corrupt or that the news is fake, well, then maybe it's true. They believe Americans. And so that's another reason why it's so incredibly important to stand up and refuse to accept this new normal. It's not normal, and we should not accept it.
Christiane Amanpour, her PBS show goes to 1 hour in July under the new name of Amanpour and Company. I and many of my listeners will be watching. Welcome officially, more permanently, to the public broadcasting family in this country, Christiane. Keep coming on the show, okay?
I will, and good luck with the pledge drive. I always listen and watch when I'm in the United States, and I do the podcast when I'm abroad. So,
thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.